First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
The city picks up the pieces from ELSA. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we check in with Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry on ELSA's damage and also an important new resiliency hire for the city. Then later, the Delta variant of COVID-19 and what it means for spiking cases here in our area. First, though, this hour, flooding, tornadoes, and one fatality as Tropical Storm ELSA passed through the city last night. Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry is on the line now with an update on the cleanup and the latest. Mayor, good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great, thanks. And we're sorry to see that there was one fatality last night from ELSA as the storm passed through with part of a tree falling on a car in the city. A tragedy, to be sure, along with some tornado touchdowns and flooding. What is your office looking at this morning?
Yeah, well, a couple things, Melissa. First, that absolutely tragic that we had a fatality yesterday. You know, you just don't expect those things to happen, even though they can. So thoughts, prayers to the family. And then we had a tornado late in the day. I think one of the takeaways from this is, even though city officials and state officials had been warning for days, we got into yesterday, and you know, there wasn't as much wind and rain in the morning and even in the afternoon. And I think maybe to some people it didn't look like a serious event. And then we had a tornado. It's now been confirmed. It came down late in the day. There were quite a few cars on the road, I'm told. So just for folks to, as we go through this hurricane season, when we have a storm and a threat upon us, until it's gone, even if it looks okay, take it seriously and be smart and be safe. And I also think this is a time to really regroup and make sure you have your storm kit and you know your evacuation zone and you're prepared. This is early in the season. I didn't expect we'd be dealing with this over the 4th of July weekend, but here we are.
Yes, exactly right. Which brings me to another headline that's happened this week. You have chosen your pick to be the city's new chief resiliency officer. Her name is Ann Coglianese. Certainly, this city is only going to be dealing with more of this, as all Florida cities are. More storms, earlier storms, stronger storms, more flooding, more severe weather. This is an important new hire for the city. It is pending city council approval. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, sure. Well, Matt Carlucci, who was really interested in this months ago, and this was a priority of his, he came to me and us, the administration, and we've been eyeing something like this, but we decided to move. Look, Ann has a tremendous resume, tremendous experience, both in Washington, D.C., and the White House, and the Obama administration, and then her time in New Orleans. And she went through the interview process and just spoke to, you know, people that are experts in infrastructure and climate and resiliency. When I interviewed her, what I really liked about her was, I mean, she is this is her passion. She's driven by this. She wants to get it right. She understands this is a long vision and a long play, and I'm excited about her coming to Jacksonville, and I'm excited about the community meeting her.
We'll learn more about it in the coming weeks. Mayor Lenny Curry, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Melissa.
Well, the other big story today, COVID-19 and the worrisome spread of a highly contagious variant of the virus, the Delta variant as it's being called. Cases and hospitalizations are ticking back up again in our area. And what we're hearing from local hospitals is that almost everyone getting sick enough right now to come in and get treated and need oxygen has not been vaccinated. Dr. Sunil Joshi is president of the Duval County Medical Society Foundation. He's on the line now. Dr. Joshi, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Always good to have you. And we want to hear from everyone, As we talk about the Delta variant of COVID, it's 549-2937. Give us a call, emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa Injax, or weigh in on Facebook. How widespread is the variant here? What are the numbers you're seeing? It's kind of hard to get numbers, doctor, since the state is only putting them out once a week now, but what are you seeing?
Yeah, it is hard to know exactly what's happening with the Delta variant. We do know nationally the Delta variant has now become the dominant variant in terms of infections throughout the country. About 52% of all infections are related to the Delta variant. So you can extrapolate that it may not be quite as bad here, but the numbers are moving into that direction. So again, much like the flu virus, you know, has variations throughout a season, COVID is doing the same thing, and that really is not much of a surprise.
Not much of a surprise. You know, Jacksonville City Councilwoman Jacoby Pittman is in the hospital being treated for COVID-19. She's not the first local public official to get the disease. We are hearing that most of the people being treated right now needing, because if you go to the hospital, basically that means you are sick enough to need oxygen.
Yes.
And so we are hearing that the cases coming in are the unvaccinated. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, over 99% of the cases that are requiring hospitalization, not just here in the Duval County area, but throughout the state and even throughout the country, are of the unvaccinated. Now, again, I don't think any of us know the vaccination status of the councilwoman, but you know, taking that into account, you know, we're all hoping and praying that she'll be out of the hospital sooner than later. And also keep in mind that, you know, the groups of people that are at the highest risk of requiring hospitalization from COVID are our elderly folks, you know, people over the age of 65 in particular. But if those folks are vaccinated, their risk goes down significantly. And so I think that's why we're starting to see some younger people being the predominant group being hospitalized, because that's also the group of folks that are not getting vaccinated as well.
So you recommend that parents get their kids vaccinated now, any child 12 and up?
I do recommend the vaccine, obviously, for children and young adults, which are the groups of folks that right now are lagging behind in vaccination rates. I know that there is a concern about myocarditis in particular in boys between the ages of 12 and 16. I've had my children vaccinated. My son is 13 years old. He received the Pfizer vaccine. They're doing well with it. And remember, the FDA did look at the data regarding myocarditis. And yes, there is a little bit of a blip there in which there are more cases of myocarditis in the vaccinated compared to the general population. However, the risk of myocarditis, if you were to get COVID-19, is 10 times higher than it is with the vaccine. And so again, you have to balance the risks and benefits, and it certainly is up to the parent and it's a parent's decision, but I think it's important for them to get both sides of the story.
It's 549-2937. Call us up now as we speak with Dr. Sunil Joshi of the Duval County Medical Society Foundation. We're talking about vaccinations. Okay, there was an Israeli study that found that the Pfizer vaccine was only 64% effective or something like that against this new Delta variant. But that said, it is very effective against preventing hospitalization and death. The Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines as well, according to what we are seeing. So what's your message to people out there who still are hesitant? They don't believe the vaccines are safe or effective, particularly with this new variant.
Right. And so, yeah, when you hear that the vaccine is only 64% effective against the Delta variant, of course, the first thing is like, wow, that's so much lower than it was with the original Alpha variant of COVID-19, where there was 94% effectiveness. And so that makes people concerned. But remember that 94-95% effectiveness rate for any vaccine is just crazy outstanding to begin with. Okay. And so a 64% effectiveness rate means that you're 64% of the folks who got the vaccine tested negative, you know, compared to the folks that didn't get the vaccine. And so
that doesn't necessarily mean that they had severe disease. And that's why it's important to look at hospitalizations and severity of illness after receiving the vaccine. And so it was still 94% effective at preventing hospitalization, which is associated with severe outcomes related to the virus. And so ultimately, that's why we get vaccines. You know, we don't necessarily get a vaccine so that we don't pick up the flu. We get the vaccine so that we don't get sick enough to require hospitalization, the long-term morbidity associated with the virus, or of course death associated with viruses. And so ultimately the goal is to keep people from requiring hospitalization. That's why this whole thing started. That's why this whole push for wearing masks and social distancing and vaccinating folks started, was because remember what happened in New York City just a year and a half ago, or what happened in China and Italy. And so our goal has been to try to avoid that.
Yeah. What about the other variants? We're hearing the next wave of this may be the Lambda variant. Mm-hmm. Unvaccinated people, they're keeping this going, aren't they? They're keeping these waves alive. Talk about that if you could.
Right. And that's why getting vaccinated is important. Okay. Because, yes, the vaccines were initially set up in a way that was for the original COVID virus that came out, but it still works on the variants. As you can see, 94% effective at keeping people out of the hospital, even with the Delta variant. The same thing is very likely to be true with the other variants that come through. And so the more and more people that are vaccinated, the less and less likely that this virus itself is likely to spread. And so as it's spreading, those little variations in the virus DNA tend to dominate, and as they dominate, they become the more predominant version of the virus, and some of those versions are more likely to cause infection and more likely to cause illness, and so what we're seeing is that the folks that are not vaccinated are the ones that are being sick enough to require hospitalization. So the more and more of those folks that we can get vaccinated, the less and less hospitalizations we will need, and we'll get, faster to the end of this pandemic.
Right. 549-2937 to connect with Dr. Joshi, Duval County Medical Society, Elaine in St. Augustine. Hi, Elaine. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'm wondering what the recommendation is for mothers who are nursing. I know there probably haven't been a lot of studies on that, but what is the recommendation now?
Okay. Thank you, Elaine. Doctor, I believe the recommendation is they're like everyone else to get vaccinated. Is that right?
Absolutely. The recommendation in the scenario in which a mom is breastfeeding is to be vaccinated just like you would with the flu vaccine in that scenario. Remember, this is not a live virus. It's not a live vaccine. And so there's no concern of risking of transmitting the virus to the nursing infant. And so the recommendation is no different than it is for another woman of childbearing age.
Yeah. Speaking of babies and pregnancy, can you please do me a favor and debunk once again the false information that's been circulating that this vaccine will somehow affect fertility? That is simply not true. But I hear all the time from women and husbands of women who say, well, my wife doesn't want to get the vaccine because she's worried it will impact her ability to have a baby. And that's not true.
And I don't know where this started, and so, no, it is not true. And so there's plenty of data of women of childbearing age who received the vaccine and went on to get pregnant. There's also data of women who received the vaccine while they were pregnant and went on to have healthy children. There is no question that the virus itself can lead, if a pregnant woman were to be infected with COVID-19, it can lead to premature pregnancy, premature delivery, hypertension in pregnancy, and bad outcomes. And so the virus is associated with worse outcomes in pregnancy, and the vaccine is there to prevent that from happening. So the fertility issue, which I'm not sure how it started, is another one of these social media creations. you know, does not appear in any way to be associated with this vaccine or any vaccine. There's no vaccine in this country's history that's been associated with infertility.
549-2937 to join us. Here's an email from a listener. Please emphasize that people who have been infected by COVID still need the vaccine. Many people who've had the illness are under the false impression that surviving COVID protects them. It only protects for a short time. We are seeing patients now that have had COVID twice. Dr. Joshi, if you've had COVID once, you should still be vaccinated, correct?
100% agree with that. So the antibodies that you develop as a result of natural infection are good, obviously. They are never as good as being vaccinated. So these vaccines increase antibody levels and in this case, T-cell immunity at a much higher level even than natural infection does. And so, yes, it's fine to wait the 90 days after you've been infected if you want to give it the full 90 days before you go and get the vaccine, but you should still get the vaccine if you want that full protection.
549-2937. Teresa in Ponte Vedra. Good morning, Teresa. Go ahead.
Good morning. I wondered if the doctor would recommend that children under the age of 12 who are going to camps or school programs go ahead and mask again because of the Delta variant.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's talk about kids, doctor, because kids under 12 are not yet eligible to be vaccinated. They're going to be going back to school this August without masks, and they're going into camps now. What about this? Oh, let me pitch. Sorry, I had you on hold there. Go ahead, Dr. Joshi.
I'm sorry. Yeah, no, that's a really good question because we all know that the CDC guidelines right now suggest that for fully vaccinated people, masking is not necessary in outdoor avenues and in indoor areas where it's not overly crowded. But it doesn't really say much about the children who are unvaccinated. And so in that scenario, you know, it depends on the camp itself. You know, and each camp will be different. If it's an indoor camp with a large number of people where social distancing is not going to be able to be done, yeah, I would, if a mom came to me and asked me that question in the office, I would recommend masking in that scenario. Now, a lot of people say, well, gosh, you know, the kids under the age of 12 are the least likely to keep the masks on. And that's actually not what we saw the school year. The elementary school students were very good at keeping their masks on. It was actually the older kids that were less likely to do so. And so if the camp counselors, the camp itself would recommend the masks, I think that would help. And I think that the parents would be willing to comply in that scenario.
You know, parents are so worried about sending their kids back to school this fall if they are still not able to be vaccinated. Young kids. How concerned are you about that?
Well, it depends on the scenario. Again, keep in mind that what we have learned over the last year is that young children do not seem to be passing the virus back and forth to each other. The biggest concern, and of course, the younger children typically do not have more severe outcomes if they were to be infected with the virus. The biggest issue has been the children passing it on to their parents or grandparents or other people in their close circle who may have more debilitating health conditions or maybe older and are at risk of bad outcomes from the virus. If that extended family, if the parents, the grandparents have been vaccinated, then yes, it would be great if these younger kids can be vaccinated. When the time comes, I would certainly recommend that they are. But the chances of them spreading it then to the family members is significantly lessened simply by the fact that the rest of the family has been vaccinated. Again, another reason for the rest to be vaccinated, so these young kids who cannot receive the vaccine yet are still protected.
We're hearing that hospitals are slowing or halting elective surgeries once again because they're dealing with so many more COVID patients. Is that true?
You know, I haven't heard that to be true here yet, because even though our hospitalizations for COVID have increased, our hospital capacities, at least as of earlier this week, seem to still be okay. I think what happened last year is that as we were starting to get worried about hospital capacity, reaching hospital capacity, then suddenly elective procedures had to be put on hold because a lot of these folks require hospital beds at that point, and those hospital beds would then be taking away from seriously critically ill people with either COVID or other life-threatening conditions, and so they had to then back off on the elective procedures. I have not heard that to be the case yet, but and I'm hoping that doesn't happen, but of course time will tell.
Right. Okay, so the overriding message you have to everyone listening is just please go get vaccinated. And, you know, about a third of the population is really resisting this. So what's your message to them?
Yeah, my message to them, if they do not have a reason not to be vaccinated, of course, there are some folks who may be allergic to some of the components of the vaccine or have had a serious outcome with previous vaccines in the past. If there's none of that going on, my recommendation and my plea to them is to strongly consider getting the vaccine. Talk to your healthcare provider directly, and if he or she offers a vaccine, you may feel more comfortable getting the vaccine in that setting, because that's another thing that we have heard from patients is they prefer to get it in our office as opposed to at a pharmacy or at some other location. So please talk to your healthcare provider. Talk to other people who have been vaccinated. Talk to them about their side effects. Talk to them about how they feel now mentally about being out in public and going grocery shopping without their mask on and all these things. There's so many benefits to being vaccinated. The benefits clearly outweigh the risks of the vaccine and certainly outweigh the risk of the virus at this point.
Yeah. Let me just add a personal note. Our 18-year-old daughter has been fully vaccinated. Our 15-year-old daughter has been half vaccinated. I have to take her actually this week to get the second dose. I took her to a Walgreens because the vaccination site at the Regency Mall is shut down now.
Yeah.
But you can go just about anywhere to vaccinate. So, and it's free and you don't need an appointment most places because the demand has slowed is what I experienced.
Yes.
You can just walk right in and get the shot.
Absolutely. And as I said earlier, my 15-year-old daughter is vaccinated. My 13-year-old son is vaccinated. I feel very, very comfortable vaccinating my own children. And I hope that our listeners will feel the same way.
Yeah. Both our kids had mild symptoms after the shot, as adults have. And our oldest is actually flying somewhere today. And I feel very reassured that she's not traveling unvaccinated because traveling can increase your risk of getting sick. Let me, if I could, put one more caller on. It's Robert in St. Johns County. Go ahead, Robert.
Hi, this is Bob. I have a family member who was recently diagnosed with cancer on the base of his tongue, and his doctor had told his family that the COVID vaccine would have accelerated the growth, and I can't find anything to confirm that.
Okay, Robert, thank you. Dr. Joshi.
Yeah. Yeah, so again, there's no data to suggest that that would be the case. And so I would feel much more comfortable if your family member was vaccinated. Of course, they will very likely be going through aggressive treatment that may indeed reduce his immune system, and being vaccinated may be very, very helpful to prevent his likelihood of developing COVID with treatments and doctor's visits and hospitalizations for all the other things that he may have to go through. And so I would consider that there is no data to suggest that a vaccine that stimulates the immune system to develop specific immunity against a particular protein will stimulate any other part of the immune system. So no, I would feel more comfortable if he was vaccinated.
I hope that helps you, Robert. And Dr. Sunil Joshi with the Duval County Medical Society Foundation, always good to have your insights. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Much more still ahead, meanwhile, later in the hour. It's going to be Christmas in July this weekend for the local Salvation Army and their Red Kettles. We'll tell you all about it. But up next.
One of the things I learned about public art was that if you create art that is interactive and engaging, that it generates a lot of people traffic.
We speak with the Florida artist competing to create a landmark public art installation for the city's riverfront. That's next. Well, Orlando artist Jeffrey Manuel has built a global reputation for creating dynamic and distinctive public art pieces, installations in public parks and other urban spaces that have become absolute icons for their cities, attractions. He's part of a local design competition for our Jacksonville Riverfront. Jeffrey, who is part of the Perkins and Will team, submitted a $12 million public art design that has drawn a lot of attention. You can see renderings of it online on our website and other places, and it could end up becoming the signature piece on the waterfront if it's chosen. I spoke with him about how public art drives energy and economic development in cities. Take a listen. Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Melissa. Thanks for having me today.
Great to talk to you. So with this design competition for the downtown Jacksonville Riverfront, your design submission got a lot of attention, in particular with this striking piece of public art that would be a centerpiece. Tell us about your vision and what the public art installation is all about.
Well, there was a competition issued by the city, the DIA, and I just want people to understand that I'm just a portion of the overall judging of the overall competition. So the competition includes designing a park as well as including development parcels for a hotel, a restaurant, another development parcel possibly for an office, but then also a public art piece, which they call iconic. So they wanted something iconic, which was defined in the art, the request for a proposal, that is something that they've seen like in other major cities before. And so that's sort of how I responded.
Yeah, like the bean in Millennium Park in Chicago is the one that I think of the most. Is that sort of what you were going for?
Well, it's interesting because, the bean, or what's known as Cloud Gate, I actually worked on Millennium Park a long time ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was sort of one of my original. I started off in the urban design background, landscape architecture, before I became a full-time artist. And one of the things I learned about public art was that if you create art that is interactive and engaging, that it generates a lot of people traffic. I mean, there's a lot of great public art in a lot of different cities, but a lot of it becomes, I don't want to belittle artists, but becomes decoration, right? And so my task has always been in these cities is to actually create art that is iconic enough that generates people traffic. And cities love the idea of generating these things that are strong enough to generate people traffic that then generate buying power and actually generate businesses that want to be part of it, because especially now that we're in such a social media selfie capital world, it's sort of like, you go to other major cities, like Denver's got the giant Big Bear at the convention center. There's the Spoon and the Cherry over in Minnesota. So cities have defined themselves through public art. But the interesting thing about this concept is I took them through sort of the history of public art and then reminded them, do we really want to be just another public art piece, or do we want to be that, do we want a public art piece that's an icon that could be associated and strong enough to be part of your skyline, just like you would see the Eiffel Tower or the Arc de Triomphe or the Statue of Liberty. I don't have to tell you what cities those are in, just because you know what those are. And if you've seen the skyline silhouettes, I've seen these silhouette drawings, and I did that in my proposal. I showed them, a city of a Jacksonville skyline, and I said, if you showed this to any other person in Europe or another country, would they know where it is? But if I showed you this silhouette of Paris with the Eiffel Tower, you know it is Paris, right? Even without even telling you what it is, without understanding what buildings there are. So that's where I took it at heart, is the idea that, what can I do that can create a piece of iconic art that would make you get off of 95, make you get off the highway on the way to Savannah up north to go to downtown Jacksonville? And that was the challenge I took at. And that's a really hard task, how to create something that iconic that you'd want people to come downtown and see it.
So describe the piece for people that are listening and haven't seen the artist's renderings. Paint a picture of this concept that you drew and submitted.
So for me as a public artist, I'm not necessarily what I would call a studio artist. Public art is really about site-specific, one-of-a-kind art that talks about the city. A lot of other people I've competed with are amazing studio artists, but I've always said, do you want another so-and-so that you've seen in another city? You know, so what makes this Jacksonville? And I think the whole competition should already have been about the St. John's River in terms of a theme or a concept, because I think that is the number one thing that keeps coming up in all these public hearings and public meetings about what makes Jacksonville. So we did a inventory and a survey of what they feel Jacksonville is all about. And it's really about the history of the river. So I looked at that literally and studied the St. John's River and that how it had evolved all the way from Lake George down south, Stanford, to all the way up to Jacksonville and hit all these cities. I did this amazing animation of the river as it hit all these different cities and the history that was part of each of these cities that helped evolve its history and its culture and its landforms and everything that developed along each of the river cities. And as we got to Jacksonville, there were so many things that we could have gone to in terms of its history with shipping, its history with the Civil War, its history with its settlers, history with the Indians. But it all revolved everything back to the river. And so what I thought was, you know, why don't we just make the river the actual sculpture itself and imagine this river coming out of the water in a scripted liquid fluid form that forms this abstracted series of images or form shapes that people can interpret in three different ways. One is originally I had kept drawing this idea of a giant anchor that had, you know, a knot, like a heart. So the first letter or the first symbol looks like a anchor from one side and then with a heart symbol in the middle and then this idea of an X. But then when people started moving around it, people thought it said the J was looking like an I and saying, oh, my God, it looks like I love Jax. Or even from a certain angle, mm-hmm. It looks like it says J-A-X.
Yeah.
And so I think I didn't really, my job wasn't to create a sign, that was a literal interpretation of saying J-A-X, but was creating this scripted river form of history that's encapsulated into a polished mirror silver sculpture that rises out of the river that creates these three landform images that people can interpret in any way.
That's what I think is, the beauty of it. It's in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, abstract. No, not even abstract, but art is how you want it to interpret it and how does it make it feel to you. And the last little detail, just to give it back to some specifics about Jacksonville, is the height of the actual piece. People are saying, why is it 151? 151 translates to 1822 inches. Which is when Jacksonville was founded, and the tonal linear feet of the sculpture of the anchor is 310 feet, which represents the miles of how long the St. John River is.
Huh. So much thought put into this. It's very intentional. So if it's chosen, what will that mean for you as an artist?
This is, believe it or not, not one of my largest sculptures. My largest sculpture is in my homeland right now in the Philippines. I'm Filipino. There was the other reason why I wanted to come to Jacksonville because there are over 13,000 Filipino Americans in Jacksonville because of the
Navy. That's right, yeah.
And actually, it's the highest demographic of Filipinos in all of Florida are in Jacksonville.
Yep, we've got even have a Jollibee restaurant here.
Yes, oh my God, you know Jollibee?
Yes, yes.
So if you have a Jollibee, you know there's Filipinos there.
That's right.
That's where it is. But my homeland, I'm doing a 24-story sculpture there, sort of the same height as the Statue of Liberty. I'm doing a giant 150-foot heart sculpture in South Florida. So my job for a long time is having to help cities create an identity through art so that can actually be part of their skyline. And so in terms of what this would mean to me, I think in general, I think anytime you get a public art investment in any city, I think it's a victory on its own. But to do something where it becomes iconic and becomes a place of destination is sort of brings happiness and joy to people in these times is actually what's even more important to me. You know, I think a lot of the sculptures that I've done around the world, it's interesting. I just tell the city the owner, just hashtag the name of your city, and tell me what are the top things being selfied or Instagrammed. And a lot of them are cultural elements, such as art and sculpture. And so this is what I hope this does for the city.
Well, thank you.
Makes people want to go to Jacksonville.
Yeah, exactly. Makes people want to come here. Artist Jeffrey Manuel, it's a pleasure to hear more about your insights and your inspiration into your public art. And so thank you so much for being with us.
No, thank you.
Well, the new Jack's Natural Healing Center is opening in San Marco Monday. They will offer natural healing methods like yoga, meditation, and functional medicine. And classes will be offered in both English and Spanish. This will be the city's first Latina-owned yoga studio. Alejandra Amaguin is the owner of the Jack's Natural Healing Center, and she's on the line. Good morning, Alejandra.
Hi, good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Good to talk to you. In these times, we need all the help we can get to promote mental and physical health. So it's exciting to have a new center opening and also one that's bilingual. Tell us about Jack's Natural Healing.
Yeah, so it's a work in progress that started back in 2018. You know, we started with just kind of like a little vision of just this place where people could go. And I'm a firm believer that healing doesn't just come from a pill or medicine. It comes from an entire work over, you know, all your stress management, your sleep cycles, your nutrition, obviously, you know, but also managing trauma and going back to uncover and heal those issues. You know, the trauma lives in the fascia, in the bones, in the tissue. So healing that is part of getting healthy. So I envision this place where we would offer all of these elements, these resources to be able to get people truly healthy. So it's been coming along since 2018, and as I've been evolving in my own healing, it came down to 2021, like, okay, I know what we're doing. I know what we need to offer. And so, and it's things that I needed to pull from as well for my own personal healing.
Yeah, so, talk about that if you could a little bit.
Yeah. So I grew up, I immigrated here from Mexico as a young child, you know, and I did not have the best childhood, full of a lot of abuse, and also experienced sexual abuse, and then a brutal rape into my college years. So I grew up with all this trauma, Melissa, and I didn't understand when I came to be 40, why I was so miserable, why I was so unhappy. And I just kept trying to fill my life with, you know, oh, marriage is, I was married 3 times. Why can't I keep a relationship? You know, partying, you know, alcohol, just jumping from like job to job. And I just was so miserable. And although I had 2 amazing children, I just also felt that I was not a good mother. And, you know, my reactions were very unreasonable, or just very sporadic. I couldn't, I wasn't able to articulate how I felt. And when somebody would ask me, you know, would challenge me to say how I was feeling, I would get very defensive. So when that all stemmed from, you know, operating from a trauma response, I wasn't really operating as myself, as Alejandra Amegan, is who I was. I didn't even know who I was. And so, you know, at the age of 40, you know, three marriages, two kids, completely unhappy. I'm like, what now? And that's when I discovered yoga. And so as I started moving my body, you know, triggers, I would start to feel things that I'd buried for so long. And as I would start to feel them, you know, I could hear, you know, my instructor in the background, breathe, you know, use the body, plant the feet. And I realized that when I was listening and taking the instruction of moving my body and breathing in certain ways, it was actually releasing trauma as I was moving and breathing. And it felt like a war that I eventually won, but it was a war within myself during that movement. And it, you know, I've come now, I've been practicing for 4 years, you know, became an instructor, and I am just now getting to the point where I can, when I get triggered, I'm more aware of it. So it never really goes away, but I'm aware of it, and I can use the movement. I can use the breath. I can, you know, say, okay, this is what's happening, and I understand it now. So before I couldn't even place that at all, these feelings, these emotions, these triggers. And so now I'm able to create, I'm able to open a center, I'm able to do all these things that before, there's no way I could have done.
Wow, what an amazing arc you've had. Well, and you know, what I love about this is, not only do you have this really personal connection based on your life experience, you're going to help others with the traditional stuff like yoga, chiropractic, Zumba. Mm-hmm. By the way, you'll have free yoga and Zumba classes next Monday and Tuesday when you open, breathwork, meditation classes, but also some stuff that people might not be as familiar with, like red light therapy and a therapy called PEMF, pulseless electromagnetic field. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so it's electroregenerative therapy. So how that works is, so we use it for clients who have got neck pain, back pain, migraines, strains, the occasional strain, or even just spasms. And so our cells, just over time, just like a battery, will lose their charge. So the way that the electromagnetic field therapy works is it recharges the cells. And it works on the whole cell, whereas we also offer the red light, which just works on the mitochondria. So the red light's good. That one I would recommend for like acne or puffy skin or just a little bit of inflammation. But the electromagnetic one just goes a little bit deeper. So it just goes deeper into the cell and it works on the whole cell.
And this is the first Latina-owned yoga studio in town, and it will be bilingual, right?
Yes, correct. Yes, it will be. And also, we will be on a sliding scale to make it affordable and accessible to all. But yes, I'm really excited about our Spanish classes. I recently started teaching in Spanish, and that was another huge milestone for me to teach in my native language. Was a huge experience for me to teach, to go back to my roots and where I come from and who I am, and then now to express it in a yoga sense was just incredible. So I know that the Jacksonville community needs it, that our Spanish-speaking community needs it.
It's
not
sure.
Anything that's offered. Yeah, and so what a gift. Like my intention in all of this.
Absolutely.
Is
to bring it to the whole community. We're almost out of time, so check out JacksonvilleNaturalHealingCenter.com. They are located at 1550 Hendricks Avenue in San Marco, and the opening is Monday with some free classes, Monday and Tuesday.
Yes.
So Alejandra Amegan, founder and CEO, we look forward to lots of success. Namaste.
Thank you so much. Namaste.
And in a moment, how you can help the Salvation Army's Christmas in July campaign this weekend. We'll be right back.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com. Columbia College offers virtual, in-seat, and online classes for undergraduate and graduate degrees. Columbia College, proudly serving veterans and active military. Info at ccis.edu/Jacksonville or 904-338-9150.
I'm Marco Werman. On the world, we get an outside perspective.
I love lots of things about Russia.
We all share the love for Syria.
Because getting outside yourself can be a good thing.
The act of empathy is fundamentally an act of imagination. It's a, somebody says to me, Kwame, I can't imagine what you go through as a black person. And I'll say, try.
It is the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, a case that illustrates the inequality of mass incarceration, we talk with journalist Emily Bazelon, who writes about the criminal justice system, and helped an incarcerated young man who wrote her claiming his innocence. Bazelon teamed up with her sister, Lara, a law professor. We'll also talk with the man they helped get exonerated, Utico Briley. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Could you live without caffeine? Best-selling author Michael Pollan says he found the experience literally mind-bending.
Every culture on Earth has some plant that they use to change consciousness. This just seems to be a deep human desire.
Michael Pollan on the ups, downs, and all arounds when it comes to psychoactive plants. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The Northeast Florida Salvation Army is holding a Christmas in July Red Kettle event this weekend. And they're also working to change perceptions that they are anti-LGBT. I spoke about it with local Major Keith Biggers. Take a listen.
Major Biggers, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Melissa, for having me.
So tell us about the Red Kettle campaign, Christmas in July.
Yeah, our women's auxiliary group decided to have this Christmas in July silent auction and vendor expo on the 10th, this coming Saturday, at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. And that will begin at 10 o'clock in the morning and conclude at 3 p.m. And we have, I believe we have approximately 400 silent auction items. We're going to have vendors there. We'll have food trucks parked outside, and tickets are $10 a person, including the swag bags for the first 200 guests, and kids 17 and under are free to enter. And if the person brings a new toy valued at $5 or above, they will receive $5 off of any auction item that they bid on. And so this is an opportunity for us to enable our Angel Tree program to have greater support and be able to meet all the increased needs that we've experienced this last couple of years.
Right. And summertime in particular is tough. Donations tend to fall off. So this is timely, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It really is, I think, really a wonderful ideal of the women's group that we have. I mean, we must have about 50 to 60 wonderful women volunteers that serve on the auxiliary. And when they first introduced something unique like this, we were all on board and excited about it. And being that it's the first time event, we've had wonderful support and have sold many tickets, and looking forward to the turnout. And like you said, the financial support that it will provide us in enabling us to continue on doing the services that we do throughout the year, especially during the busy Christmas season with the Angel Tree program.
Right. And the Red Kettles, what, you know, whether they're in July or at Christmas, are such a familiar sight, and your social services help so many people. I want to ask you as a follow-up, what's your message to those who would not donate to the Salvation Army? Because in the past, they've perceived that it discriminated against LGBTQ Americans. I know that your organization has sought to change that perception in recent years.
Yeah, well, there is that misconception. You know, the Salvation Army welcomes all, serves everyone with love, with hope, without discrimination. It's in our mission statement that we preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and meet human needs in his name without discrimination. And our services are equally available to anyone. Our commitment to provide service without discrimination is an extension of our mission, committed to becoming a more welcoming, diverse organization that stands as a model for inclusion and anti-discrimination. We ask no questions of anyone that comes through our doors as far as gender, ethnicity, race, beliefs. Any such questions are not allowed. And we have individuals that come every day, 365 days a year, to receive services at the Salvation Army with no questions asked such as that. We take very strong standards to make sure that we meet those standards, that all are welcome and none are turned away because of any such, whether it's LGBTQ or whether it's race or religion or whatsoever. Unfortunately, there is that misconception, but I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt that we are an equal employment opportunity as well, employer. And so we provide the same benefits to all of our employees. We welcome and encourage a diverse workforce because it helps us to better serve a diverse community.
So with all of that said, can you remind us quickly once again how people can look out for you, the Red Kettles, this weekend?
Well, they can visit us at the Prime Osborne from 10 to 3. We'll be having, like I said, all kind of great activities, food, vendors, great silent auction items. And they can come in $10 or $5 with a gift. They can have $5 off on auction items. And all the donations that will be received will stay in town, stay here in Jacksonville. And all the funds raised will continue to enable us to provide services that we provide every day. We are only able to do all of these programs and these services because of the wonderful, generous support of those in Northeast Florida and here in Jacksonville that makes it possible.
Major Biggers, thanks so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Melissa. Appreciate it.
Check him out this weekend, and thanks for listening along, with thanks to producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortzfield. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back right here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.